Well, it is a great pleasure here for the first time to be recording an interview for my podcast on nostalgia in the United States. I'm with Derek Dashke.
Hi, Chris.
Great to meet you. And of course, we're both here reviewing films
for
the Journal of Religion and Film.
Yeah.
And I think we both have very sort of circuitous routes here. But do you want to say a little bit about why you're here in Salt Lake City?
Well, if we want to go back to what drew me in for the very first time, I teach at the Truman State University in Kirksville, Missouri, which is sort of halfway between Kansas City and St. Louis, and I've always been interested in film. I teach religious studies, and it had always been in the back of my mind that it would be great to do a religion and film course, but I never got around to creating it. And then round about 2010 or so, some students wanted to do a readings course, directed readings on religion and film. I said, well, yeah, I would love to do that, but here's the deal. We'll do the course and your final project is you write my syllabus, and then I will teach that course. And that's exactly what I wound up doing with one of the young men, Mark Lambert, who is himself now has a doctorate from the University of Chicago Divinity School, like John and I do. And so really, really talented young man. And he was my teaching assistant. And he reached out to find John Lydon and Bill Bleszik and brought them in as guest lecturers. And then following that, Bill reached out to me and said, hey, next year, 2012, we're going to Sundance Film Festival, and how would you like to be on the editorial board of the journal Religion and Film and come out and review films with us? And I said, that sounds like the greatest thing I've ever heard of. Yeah. And so I did that 2012, 2013, and then this is my first time back in 10 years.
Yeah, and it's an amazing area to work in because
yeah.
I did a PhD in this. I know a lot of people came to this, like John, later on, in the sense that they had a PhD in a different area, but then became specialists in religion and film. So in the late 90s, suddenly it was like everything is coming together, the whole set of interests, the background in theology,
yeah.
and then this love of film, and then suddenly, you know, finding the right project to take that forward. So was that similar in your case, or is the religion and film area something that came a little bit later, or was that always part of your studies?
It definitely came later, but I would say, broadly speaking, I always think of myself as doing religion and culture generally. Yeah. My background actually has been in biblical studies and ancient Judaism, but also psychology of religion and some of the social scientific theories of religion. So I'm not very much a theory kind of guy. And then when I was working, well, actually I started in as an undergraduate, I actually double majored in psychology, which was my first major. But then I started taking the distribution requirements, and where I went, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, you could take courses in religion, and they would variously, depending on the course content, they would apply as your historical perspective or your philosophical perspective. So I started taking a bunch of courses in religious studies just to fulfill distribution requirements. And then I realized, oh, this is what I really like to do. And then I also realized, oh, and this is really just psychology of a different sort. So, you know, I double majored and then I actually brought them together in an undergraduate honors thesis where I did a Jungian reading of the mystical divine union of Meister Eckhart. And so that kind of launched me into psychology of religion. And then I like to say when I went to graduate school, I went from being sort of happy and unified as an undergraduate to being kind of depressed and fractured as a graduate student. And so my dissertation was on Freud and the apocalypse. And that turned out to have, I finished my dissertation and graduated in 2000. So I had a very millennial type of project coming out of there. And it just sort of helped me kind of see the world through lenses that otherwise one would not normally put together. And then just because I was fortunate enough to get hired at Truman State University, and they really just gave me free rein to create what it is I wanted to create. I was teaching the course on theory and method and religious studies, and I started really thinking about the ways in which film could be a stand-in for the religious experience and all the different pieces of religion that we like to look at as religious scholars. And then when I met John Lydon through creating this course, and his book, Film as Religion, was really a way of kind of a mission statement along those lines. And so I really just, you know, when we created this course with my students, it became a way of me sort of doing religious studies, but with a different cultural medium. Mm-hmm. And so I've taught that for about a dozen years now. And so it did come later, but was sort of a natural evolution of a lot of things that I was already doing.
And I love the idea of Freud of the apocalypse. And having watched quite a few films here at Sundance, where there is a character who's a therapist or a psychoanalyst, I can imagine you going and saying, I'm doing this long project, it's taking me 3 or 4 years on Freud of the apocalypse, so are you the right person to steer me forward? They go, oh, I'm not sure I'm qualified. finding a right therapist to help me with that project.
Well, and sort of, you know, one of my I like to think it's clever insights into that was in the Jewish apocalyptic tradition, there are angels or sometimes even God himself who will come to this distressed apocalyptic seer who exhibits all the signs of melancholia or depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. And these angelic figures basically are therapists. And in fact, in the studies in the Latin, they're called angelus interpretus. So they're interpreting angels, and they kind of put you out on this metaphysical couch, and they talk about, why are you so sad? And the answer is, because, you know, the empire's destroyed my temple, which is a symbol of myself. And now I have myself is in ruins and it's strewn about me. And I'm sitting here desolate among the pieces and I don't know how to put myself back together. Yeah. And then these apocalyptic narratives are stories about how one becomes whole again. But sometimes you have to go through the process of destroying yourself to get whole.
Yeah, and I think it's something that a lot of people I've spoken to about at work about this sort of feel that we all have a sort of a need. Maybe it's just something which is a creative muse.
Yes,
that kind of is a functional equivalent to therapy. I guess writing film reviews is one. I remember one colleague, she said, "Well, you write a lot of film reviews," but she said, "I guess it probably, you know, it's money that would otherwise be spent on a shrink." Or, think how much money you're saving with all of those reviews you do. And that's interesting. And I guess even a podcast and so on. There are lots of interesting sort of ways of trying to dissect the academic study of theology. I think, and it has a lot of that as well, of trying to unpack things that certainly, as I recall from growing up, I thought, what is this all about? You know, going to church, what do these texts mean? How do we deconstruct this passage? And then and then you find that through the study of something, you sort of find your way in, your own way in through the sort of the body of material. So in that sense, it sounds as though you have had a really creative academic journey.
Well, I would agree with that. And I would say, especially in the sense that that the first step in the academic process is the analysis, which is the breaking down, the dissolving. But that it can't stay there. And I know that there are some academics who just take it apart and they leave it there. But I think that the real power in academia is taking apart something that seems to be one way on the surface. And in fact, you know, obscures the truth of it, and it's usually a harmful truth on the surface, and you don't have to go too much into religion to say how much the surface of religion obscures its own harmful truths. But once you break it down, which is something that psychology and psychoanalysis also does, then you can put it back together, and that's the therapeutic part. And that's actually what I started to clue into with these apocalyptic texts, was they would start off in this place of destruction, but there would be this incredibly specific and clear healing arc from start to finish that I also noticed really very clearly mapped on to, well, one might say at different places, you know, the stages of mourning. But I was working within the Freudian tradition and was very much aligned with his Freud's essay called Mourning and Melancholia. And you start off in this part of melancholia, which is this inability to mourn. And that's where the thing that was familiar to you suddenly seems very alien. And you question your own reality, and sometimes you despair. There's one of my favorite texts is called Fourth Ezra, and he literally says, "I wish I was never born," you know, in that text. And then there's these series of visions and discussion with this therapeutic angel, and it leads them into a place where they let go of the way the world once was, and they start to accept the way the world is, and then they leave with hope for the future. And I, you know, you would not think to think about the apocalypse as in a hopeful thing, but I found just if we think about that narrative and that kind of imagery, and this is where we get back into film, if we think of these as fantasies that we have, and the fantasy is in part, you know, kind of this veiled wish that we actually can be destroyed, call that the death instinct or whatever you might want to, but this sense that maybe the world as it is not telling me the truth, and maybe it's desperately destructive in its own right, and I don't know if I can take part in this. And then to have the fantasy of, well, that happened, now you're on the other side of it, can you put yourself back together? And then that becomes actually a way of thinking through, as bad as things are, we can find a creative way forward, whatever that might be.
Yeah, as I remember watching Taxi Driver.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh.
I was only 17. It was shown at university at one of these sort of, it was called a New Ents Conference. We had traveled so far to get to the university that they put a film on for us. We stayed like a couple of evenings. And okay. So they said, we'll put a film on for you. And I never heard of this, and it stayed with me. I'm sure that I ended up writing my doctorate on in part on Taxi Driver because I was trying to unpack it. But that was that sort of notion of violence as something that could be purgative, it could be creative, it could be violence as sacramental, all in very controversial ways. But nevertheless, this sort of notion here that there's something almost you're purging something.
Yeah.
And, you know, Travis Bickle, who's not necessarily the most articulate of people, finds that through his actions, he's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to clean up the streets.
Yeah.
He sees the hypocrisy in a presidential candidate, and he thinks he's doing the right thing, even though society at large might be rather judgmental. But we sort of get into his skin and we see that he's a far more grey character, shall we say, than otherwise might be the case with somebody who's trying to do what is effectively a terrorist type endeavour. As we might construe it today, anyway. But does any of that kind of impact then on your work? That it sounds as though that sort of notion of healing through violence, or violence as a kind of way through the Book of Revelation, through some of the other texts you're referring to, they can be incredibly uplifting in some ways, because they're almost saying it's through the end you can create a new beginning.
Well, a couple things, and it's fun and interesting because it is multivalent, but one way I have described the apocalyptic literature is that they're revenge fantasies. Yes. And, you know, and let's just say in terms of violence, better the fantasy than the action. And fantasy can be very effective. And obviously, you know, through the Book of Revelation and all the Jewish precursors to it, you know, we've had this 2,000 year, envisioning a transformation through this fantasy, but this fantasy is largely, I've sometimes compared it to the ending of the movie Carrie, right? Because you have been mean to me this whole time, but it turns out I'm actually the special one, and you couldn't even be bothered to treat me with basic human kindness. And then right at the moment where it seems like somebody's going to reach out to me and treat me like a human being, then I get the worst attack on me. And then you're going to find out what kind of power I actually have. And that's very much part of these Jewish apocalypses. But that's an undercurrent of the Book of Revelation. And then, you know, 2,000 years of sort of Christian envisioning this kind of end, where you're going to find out, you're going to find out who's really right, who's wrong in that. So there's that one kind of, at least this fantasy, that violence is going to be wreaked upon my enemies. And even if I die through your violence against me, I'm going to be the one left standing in the new age, right? So, you know, if we all are raised from the dead, and there will be those who are with God and those who are against God, I'm going to be on the right side of history. or post-history when it comes to that.
Yeah, and I always remember in 2004 when The Passion of the Christ came out, at the same time you had Kill Bill Volume 2 in the cinemas.
Okay.
And some of the critics who were all very keen on Gibson's film, who perhaps hadn't demonstrated a huge amount of love either for film in general or even for Gibson's body of work before that, were also the sort of people who were very critical of Tarantino. Mm. And yet actually they both have the same structure, they both have the same sort of trajectory, and it's almost like, but because one was made from the position of faith, therefore, then we're okay with that, but the other one not so. So violence in that sense was almost being used, a very almost like transactional relative thing, that it's okay if it's used in the service of a higher end.
Sure.
But the idea then that so violence was almost in that sense simply in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah. And, it's interesting with Mel Gibson, too, because his movies very much are violent, including, you know, of course, some of the great contributions to world cinema, which would be the Mad Max films as apocalypses, which are envisioning this kind of lawless, chaotic world in which, to a degree, might make right. But Max in those worlds, with the exception perhaps of the first one of the original, Max is much more of a passive character who wants to be left alone. He's been scarred by his life. It's driven him mad, and people need help, and he would really rather not get involved. And that shred of humanity left in him says, okay, I will help you, but it's only a transaction. I'm going to do what you need me to do. I'm going to use violence where necessary to keep you and me alive, but it's nothing personal. I'm just this. And then clearly, of course, he does it because he does care. And there is a moment then at the end of these movies, and we see it especially most brilliantly in Fury Road, where he could stay. He has earned his right to stay. And he could live a life much less threatened but find some stability and find some community and maybe even find love. And he can't. He leaves. But it's like the hero walking off into the sunset after cleaning up the town is like, I cannot be in this world that I have now created, and so I have to go off and be on my own. So very much that Western trope.
Yeah. And it sounds a wonderful kind of journey for you personally, because it's pretty obvious that film has played a big role in your life. I mean, in terms of the examples that you're giving.
Yeah.
So do you want to tell me a little bit about the backstory, Derek's backstory, in terms of where you grew up, for example?
Oh, where I grew up? Well, I'm a Midwestern boy outside of Chicago, a town called Deerfield. And it's, about what you would imagine a white suburb of Chicago would look like, fairly middle class. We were adjacent to some of the more wealthy suburbs, but, it was a fairly standard middle class upbringing. And I feel like I grew up in a period of relative calm and peace, and I'm grateful for that. But I think I've always been drawn. First of all, I've always been good at academia. So, going to school was where I kind of shone. I was able to get good grades. I had, pretty good stable of friends. And so I feel like I had a fairly happy childhood in that way. But I was kind of a small kid, so I wasn't particularly athletic. So where I could shine really was in academia. But I did have a really kind of broad range of interests. And I read constantly, but I was pretty good in math and science. And I kind of just got how you deal with ideas. And obviously in the kind of real educational system that we have in the United States, you at least get rewarded for that. And I certainly wasn't going to make any great strides in athletics or anything like that. But of course, it was also the 70s. And so, this was a world in which if you wanted to see films, you had to go see them in theaters, right? And I do remember some formative experiences, but probably the most important one was I almost have a feeling this was not the first time I saw it, but it's the one I remember seeing a screening of 2001 A Space Odyssey in the basement of the public library in Deerfield. And I have vivid memories of that. And that is a movie that has just literally stayed with me my entire life.
Yeah.
And there is perhaps a project later on in my life where I will go back and revisit and say, what is it about this film? And I very often think about why this? Why did this strike me in so many ways? But certainly one thing it did was that, I was raised Lutheran. Fortunately, before some forms of Lutheranism got a little bit scary, from my point of view. So it was a perfectly fine religious upbringing. I was fairly devout in those senses, Sunday school, acolyte, those kinds of things. And so, I lived very much in the religious world, but I also was very scientifically minded, and I didn't see that there was any contradiction between the two. And perhaps something like 2001, which I think was just my first real experience of awe and mysterium tremendum et fascinans, but it's also incredibly scientific and technological. And so for me, it said these are not separate realms. And that also perhaps the kind of intelligence one displays in order to create technology through science, that's also leading us to something transformative.
And it sounds as though, and I think that's the first time Rudolf Otto has come up in my podcast.
Too bad, but here we go.
Absolutely. But I'm just thinking about that, because you saw it in the basement of the library. Mm-hmm. Now, I've always kept a diary, and there's something for me about those, like you, going to see a film with an audience, in a cinema, in a building, with the architecture and all everything that surrounds that. Matters where there's a ticket that you can show for your transaction, albeit now a digital ticket, of course. But so when you saw that, for example, and it doesn't have to be this particular film, but in terms of the fact that it was such an influential experience for you, did you see it with people, your peers? Were you did you know any of the other people there? Did you go as a group? Was it like a random, like with Taxi Driver?
Yeah.
It had this great appeal, but it was genuine, a case of, ooh, they're showing this film tonight. Well, I've got nothing else to do. I'm only 17. I don't really, what am I going to do?
Can't
what am
drink,
I going to do? I cut all of those sort of things, so I'll go and watch this. But it sounds as though that was the location of the screening and the timing of it, maybe your age as well, all sort of coalesce. And I just wonder, all these years on, whether there might be other people who were at that or similar screenings who kind of came away. And, there's a project in there somewhere, isn't there, about the fact that you all sort of had this common experience.
Oh, for sure. And I don't know how old I was. I'm going to guess that maybe I was 8 or something like that. Movie came out if I'm remembering right, the same year I was born, 68, right? And it probably been a little bit in circulation, but just how strange for it to make its way into a public library. Certainly they got a license to show it, and it was just, so it was not in a theater. It was something, but I feel like I had seen it already, but I can't place seeing it before, but I knew I wanted to see it. I knew that we probably made some effort to see it, but even if not, for whatever reason, my parents took me. And I'm sure I just went with my parents and maybe even my sister. I'm not entirely sure. But it would have been just probably a crowd of, maybe 20 of us sitting on folding chairs. And maybe some kids about my age, maybe a little older, some adults there. But it was, I do have some fairly strong memories of just being in that setting with a group of people. But just seeing one image after another that I had never even conceived of, and just then this idea that some kind of intelligence had been planted at us that was teleological, that was pointing us in a certain way, but that vehicle was technology. That was how we get there, and you need to do the technology to get to the place where whomever planted this signal would know you were ready. And I guess there's something about that message that really excited me. And maybe I guess at some level I thought, well, maybe I could be part of unlocking that.
Do you know, and I wonder whether, Because that seems to be my story as well. And there's a sense, and it's always those things, you know, the Mysterium Tremendum and all that, but yeah. the stuff that you don't understand, the things that you can't grasp,
sure.
And may never, but that ineffability of it is part of the process.
Yeah.
So it's almost as though you're not then thinking, I want the answer. I don't watch a film. I mean, actually, I get really annoyed when, it happens sometimes with like Christopher Nolan films, great though they are, people say, I know the meaning of Inception. Yes. I'm like, that is not the way I want you to get, because I come away often thinking, am I stupid or something? Because, you know, when people say to me, oh, I got it. Oh, I knew the ending 10 minutes before the end. Oh, yeah. You didn't? No, I thought you worked with film. And I think, yeah. I don't like you.
Yeah.
But that's the point, because it's the journey and it's the fact that it's had this impression on you. But there's a lot on a personal, emotional, and academic level.
Yeah.
Like you use the word teleological. Obviously, you wouldn't have been using that word at the age of 8.
No.
But of course, that you're reading back into that because this process is linear. But also, of course, you're very much going backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it's the kind of it's obviously had a significant bearing on you, not least in terms of the content of your academic research and teaching.
Sure. Yeah. And there is this part of this, we might say, this through line for my work, which is always about somehow in the psychology of transcendence. And there's my undergraduate project was on mysticism. Yeah. So I'm absolutely, some part of me is convinced that there is this human heritage that is demanding that we understand that we're able to transcend ourselves and become something beyond what we are, and there mysticism is one route for that. These imaginings of the apocalypse, what kind of world we could find ourselves in afterwards, is another one of that. I have in a other project recently with my sabbatical in 2015, I started working with some of the psychedelic plant medicines, and that's another vehicle for that. And so absolutely this sense of the technology of self-transcendence, I think, is so important. And there's two sides of that, which is one is kind of a healing side, which is I feel broken, I feel traumatized, I feel, you know, disintegrated, and it's making getting through life on Earth kind of a slog. And what if I didn't have to feel that way all the time? And you can get put back together pretty good, but then what if you want to go beyond that? What's the other side of that? What if I want to be more than this? And I think all of these things also give you the tools for, you know, being something larger than yourself.
Yeah. And also just in knowing you over the last few days, of course, music clearly plays a massive role. Indeed, some of the films, you're talking about the Indigo Girls, or you're talking about Bob Dylan, and so on. And do you want to say a little bit about that? Because that's clearly also had a really big impression on you.
Oh, for sure. Well, let's just go back to 2001, right? You know, the most famous part about 2001 is the introduction of this monolith with the Sprach Zarathustra, which is now just part of our cultural consciousness. I'm sure also lent itself to that Mysterium Tremendum for me as well. But, you know, as far as the music goes, you mentioned Bob Dylan. So when I was in college, I started getting interested in both the apocalypse from an academic point of view. And that was by way of a professor that I took named David Halperin, who kind of became a mentor to me. And I took his course on Jewish civilization, you know, as a history. And I fell in love with just the topic. So that's why I continue to work within the Jewish studies area. But then the next course he taught was on the apocalypse. And so, you know, I didn't know much about the apocalypse at the time, but I wanted to take another course with him, and this seemed interesting enough. And now it's, you know, it's in some ways it's still all I do. But the paper I wrote for that course was on Bob Dylan and the apocalypse. Mm. And so I had this incredible fortune to get to see Bob Dylan and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers play together in 1985 or 86. I actually was on Pod Dylan, another podcast to talk about the song Tombstone Blues, which is an apocalyptic song. But I told this story on that podcast where my friend Paul's brother had won tickets off the radio to go see Bob Dylan and Tom Petty. And he had a softball game, he said, and couldn't go. So he gave them gave the tickets to his brother and I, and we went, and we didn't even really look at the tickets. It was just exciting enough that we got a free show to go see Bob Dylan and Tom Petty. And then we got there, and turns out our tickets were sixth row center. And so that was my introduction to Bob Dylan, was, you know, so close that I could see him light a cigarette and put it in the neck of his guitar and then watch it burn down and then never smoke it. But, you know, mid-1980s was a good time to start looking at the back catalog of Bob Dylan, because it was a little fallow time for him as an artist right then. So I really did have this nascent academic apparatus to start thinking about him as a creative artist, but also as somebody who had really absorbed, you know, the Jewish teaching, but also the Christian teachings about the apocalypse, but then looked at the social landscape of the 1960s and kind of brought that all together. And so I kind of knew what he was doing. I knew I could understand how he was taking these old forms of thinking about the world as broken and presenting them in a way that the modern world could hear. And that paper, I just kind of pulled that apart in the ways that I would later on pull apart these Jewish apocalypses and say, I think this is what's going on, in a way that is for personal healing, but also social healing.
Yeah. And do you ever wonder whether, you know, Bob Dylan would be interested? Would it be your dream to sort of for him to know what you're saying about him, or is it?
I was sure. Detachment. As very much, I'd love to have a conversation, because I think, you know, he likes to talk about religion. He likes to talk about these things. He would never say, "Oh, you got it right." But I think as a place to begin a conversation, I think we would. At the very least, I think on that level, we would hit it off. And of course, the great thing too is that ever since then, you know, he's found his way back into it, and he's been putting out just insanely good music ever since 1989. Yeah.
What I was going to say is the Traveling Wilburys.
Traveling Wilburys.
As soon as you mentioned Tom Petty, yeah, and you mentioned 85, 86, I thought, well, that was just literally, yeah, a couple of years before, mm-hmm, the Traveling Wilburys. And that, for me, with the Handle Me With Care and, yeah, so on, that was mind-blowing stuff, because it brought all these legends together.
Yeah.
Including George Harrison and Roy Orbison. I think the only ones alive now are Jeff Lynne and Bob Dylan.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I wasn't even super aware of kind of his Bob Dylan struggles in the mid 80s as an artist. But, you know, when the Wilburys album was released, I'm like, oh, and this is exactly why I love. And I was a huge Beatles fan anyway, and George is actually my favorite Beatle. And so for George and Bob to be working together, and you know, I liked Tom Petty, and nothing wrong with Jeff Lynne either, but for all of them to come together and just this fun, interesting, you know, great rock record, you know, came out kind of right when I was most interested in his career. And it actually turns out that that record was really instrumental in getting him to start writing again. And really the first fruits of that was Oh Mercy. And that was one that I even bought the album at the time and then didn't really listen to it. But I've come back to it in large part because of this Pod Dylan podcast. And that's a fantastic album. And, you know, ever since then, you know, he has continued to reinvent himself. And so it's like, you know, I have these two strands that have kind of gone through my life. There's the 2001 Space Odyssey, yeah, strand, and then there's the Bob Dylan strand. And I might even say just in the middle, then there's the Monty Python, the Holy Grail, yeah, strand, which is a whole other, yeah, strand as, yeah, well.
Well, comedy plays a huge part.
Yeah.
Because you were showing us last night,
yeah,
this wonderful routine,
mm-hmm,
perfect stand-up act, of you talking about sort of all the paradoxes of what people think about it is to be a religion
professor. Yeah, 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 exactly. But then, you know, in the, you know, halfway through, then I started to talk about the apocalypse, because, yeah, talk to me long enough, yeah, and I'll start talking about the apocalypse.
So how did that, I mean, so obviously you can do stand-up, but the whole Monty Python thing as well, it sounds as though there's, I mean, I find this when I'm teaching. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of channeling, and it works on two levels, or maybe more than two, but there's the people who taught me all those years ago, and I'm mm-hmm. often aware that I'm using, I'll mm-hmm. refrain from saying plagiarizing, right. but I'm using their content in sure. the sense that, you know, I went to university all those years ago, and I'm teaching stuff in the same kind of area, obviously, yeah. as you'd imagine. So, and I'm very aware that even the delivery is very similar with certain people who are very charismatic mm-hmm. presenters and so on, and I sort of, you know, look up to them. So, they're very much my role models. But also outside of that, that the kind of maybe the people that you've never met, it might be the singers or the radio presenters or the comedians. So in a way, watching, because I've never obviously seen you lecture your students, but I've seen your stand up. But mm-hmm. I can imagine that it's a fairly fine line between the two. That it's performance.
It is performance. Yeah. And I'll even say there's even a more specific thing that I tend to think of myself, and it's closer to karaoke, and it's just the persona in terms of having a persona where you are kind of. There's a thing that is there that already exists, but you have to find a way to make it your own and present it to the people around mm-hmm. you. And, you know, you might be a professional in doing this, yeah. but you're not necessarily going to be the greatest deliverer of this content ever. But if you can perform it and you can connect to people on that level, and you can have this persona that is masterful but also accessible, I think just in what I've tried to create for myself as far as student experiences go, I think that's the line I like to work. When I did that stand-up, which was an invitation of one of my former students, who we had this is actually for charity, I had said I'd always wanted to try stand-up, but I'd never, you know, had the opportunity to do it. And it was very, very difficult. I recommend it, but it is really one of those things where you have to recognize that this is going to be high stakes and you're going to be uncomfortable the whole time. Yeah. And it absolutely was that. And I was so happy I got to do it. And I don't know if I could do it again.
Yeah. I mean, did you have to do lots of prep for it? Because it works with a live audience.
Yes.
And I'm guessing that in your head, because I've done a few performance things outside of academia, and you have an imaginary audience.
Yes.
And you know, however, you know, you've got your idols and you think, oh, yeah, these are the great stand-up people. Actually, I work with people who are, there's actually, and I've interviewed him as well, he's a stand-up comedian, and he's a reader in comedy, you know, so his research is in comedy and stand up, and he has lots of, you know, his generations of students who've come through and, you know, have gone down that route, but he actually does stand up as well. Mm-hmm. But I agree, because you're inhabiting a persona, I guess.
When I was developing my routine, it was very interesting to reflect on the process, because I find that, you know, and maybe you would agree with this, hopefully you would say that, I tend to be a fairly funny person, and I'm just hanging around, and things come to me very spontaneously, and even if I'm in the classroom, I'm very comfortable, and I can crack jokes, and some jokes I've crafted over the years, and I still tell them, and a lot of them are just spontaneous in the moment. And the idea of doing this intentionally, creating some sort of context where you're going to say funny things, first of all, that you can look into the future and say, okay, I need a funny thing now that I'm going to say a month from now that will still sound like I just came up with it in the moment. That's a very strange experience. But also the stranger but more educational experience was just when trying to think about jokes, how much real crap you have to go through in your own head before you start to find things that might resonate. And I was, you know, fortunately this process, and this, it was interesting because the student, this was all part of a student comedy and improv kind of troupe called Up Chuckles at Truman State University. And so we had student mentors for the faculty for doing this. But mostly I had to develop this on my own, and I would try to think some things, I would write some things out, and it was really probably 3 weeks of just nothing I would ever want to say in front of anybody, because it was just bad. I could try it out in front of my wife, and it would just be blank, you know, crickets. But you had to go, at least I had to go through that, and then probably a week, 10 days before the performance, I felt like I got that out of my system, and I started, I'm a runner, and so sometimes I would be doing about a 30-minute run, and I would start to have ideas that I could play in my head, And in that space, it was I was recreating in kind of a controlled experimental fashion the spontaneous space that you might have joshing with friends. And I could start to come up with jokes that would have been things I'd say if I were around other people. And then I would go, oh, that one was good. I can remember that. And then I would just develop these. And then actually in my rehearsal, I would do these on these runs. So I could, and then I'd say them out loud. Very nice way. I don't like this idea of doing it in front of a mirror. But if I'm running and I'm talking and I can do it that way. And so just that, it was such an unusual process for me. I'd never done anything quite like that. But it was so interesting to watch what it's like to try to create the conditions in which you can be spontaneously funny.
This is what I find interesting, because you have to be, because you can't just turn up and deliver. That would be impossible. But you have to make it sound as though this is the most spontaneous thing you've seen.
Yeah.
And I've been to shows like where singers, whatever, and to, as an icebreaker, it's obvious that they have somebody planted in the audience who will heckle. And I realised that because I saw a singer, Elaine Page, actually, and she does lots of musicals and so on, and she came on stage, and then somebody shouted out something along the lines of "Go for it, Elaine," and she came and she had this perfect rejoinder, like, "Oh, you know, I have a fan at the back and everyone loved." But then somebody else in the audience, a woman in front, who was clearly not part of the entourage, took that as her opportunity to go, "I love you, Elaine," or something. And Elaine looked really like, you know, she was like, "Well,
this wasn't part of the script."
And so she had this perfect answer to this guy at the back, but then she didn't know how to deal with that. So I thought, I know, you know, you sort of see how it all works together. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I suppose there must be a sense in which you're delivering the act, you're doing it, and presumably you've got notes, or I don't know if you're reading, and you're probably thinking, okay, I was going to go for this next, but actually I'm just going to maybe see if I'm going to go in a slightly different direction, because you're attuned, you must be attuned to the audience.
And that's the part that's most like being in the classroom. And what I kind of realized in doing that, that comedy performance was how much of comedy is this really very difficult thing of finding something that the audience is familiar enough with that you can riff on, that you have to you don't have to explain. And so, you know, just if you go back and look at some of the great comedy routines, just the setup is just instantaneously. And you either have to find something you know the audience is aware of, or you have to be incredibly economical in how you explain that. Now, in the classroom, it's super easy because you are presenting them the information. Yeah. They have it in front of you. They've done the reading. You've had the lecture, so they are familiar with the content. But you can, you know, you've had an hour or whatever to lay that out. In a comedy routine, you have seconds, you know, at most to get them to recognize what you're talking about and then pivot and say, now here's something weird I'm going to say about that. And then move on to the very, very next thing. And I still haven't quite figured out what that magic is. But I think the great comedians, and let's just say those of us who feel very, very comfortable in the classroom, we've been doing it for a long time, we can riff. And we also can find that we are, and this is one of the things that's still most exciting for me about teaching, I've been doing this 23 years now, is that even though I've done this for over two decades, I can be in the middle of my 100-level world religions course, and I can be discovering things as I'm talking that had not occurred to me before, and I could only get there because I've been doing it for 23 years. And then the next time I teach it, I have this. I have a new thing to say.
Do you know, I find that, and actually, funny enough, it's often American presidential elections. Imagine in every one that I've been teaching, whether it's 2008, you know, when it was very clear that you had, you know, it was Hillary versus Obama for the Democrat nomination. Yeah. But there are also some fascinating characters on the Republican side.
Yes.
And interesting, you know, on the spectrum. And some of them would have all sorts of views on whether it was abortion or capital punishment. Space travel, all sorts of stuff, and I always used to find that I was applying this, and it was all off the cuff. So all the sort of the interest that I have, but I was able to sort of, because we might be looking at leadership. There's a module I teach. We're looking at modern theology, and we're looking at particular models of leadership. And suddenly, all these different characters represent, you know, different models of leadership, and it seemed like the perfect. But there's no way that could have been planned.
Yes,
Because it was literally of, I was driving in this morning, and an hour ago I heard this interview where they were talking about a particular candidate, and then that was, for 5 minutes of my lecture, that was a perfect illustration
yeah.
of whatever model I was talking about. And then, 3 or 4 years later, you have another sort of round of elections, and then you have a different set of dynamics, but also you find that sort of fit. And for me, that's when teaching really takes off, because you've got your script. I come in with what mm-hmm. I'm going to say, but the worst teacher would be if I actually did nothing other than just...
Which we know they exist. They exist in there. And I think it's in part because there's maybe less so now yeah. in the time that we have been teaching, yeah. but there used to be much more of a separation between, yeah. well, here's the curriculum, mm. here's what I have planned, outside of that, here's my life, and never the twain shall meet. But I would say that in the modern era, all those lines are broken down, and I'm constantly in class saying, hey, I just listened to this podcast last night, and yeah. this is relevant. I never would have thought, oh, that's a thing I'm going to have to make reference to, but now that we're talking about, yes, this is absolutely relevant. And it is the validation of, first of all, being a person outside of your job, but also, of course, getting the chance to get outside of the classroom and do new things and go research and come to Sundance yeah. and have these experiences. And in the end, that's really what anybody's life is about, is creating the conditions in which they have interesting experiences that continue to make them make their life fulfilling in ways that they don't expect.
Yeah. And how different is that, or how similar is it,
yeah.
From your own university experience? Because I take it your degree was in this area of religious studies.
Yeah.
So did you find, obviously, so you like I did, you obviously stayed uh-huh. and are now sort of doing what, you were once a student and now you're imparting yeah. all your wisdom to students. But what sort of changes have you seen? Do you kind of, what were your reasons for doing this degree in the first place? What made you study religion? And the degree to which you've obviously put your mark on the curriculum, so you're not just somebody who studied it, you're actually yeah. somebody who actually has an input in the very curriculum, not just your own curriculum obviously, but other people's, in terms of the research and the writing that you do. So how has all that impacted on you over the years?
Well, first of all, I still to this day don't quite know why I still study religion. I mentioned earlier, I was a perfectly good kid in church, but I didn't have any drive to this. I never considered clergy or anything like that. But in fact, I entered into college as a psych major with the idea, I think perhaps, that I go on into clinical psychology yeah. and that would be my curriculum. And towards the end of my time as an undergraduate, I was still contemplating that kind of thing. But it was really when I started making these connections between psychology and religion, especially these transcendent, this mysticism, this something that, wow, there's something bigger to us that we do have access to, but it's not immediate, that I couldn't let go of that. And so I applied to divinity school and got in the University of Chicago. But I've always had this sense that religion is about mental health in a way, but also mental health is about the transcendent and the spiritual in a way. And I'm always just kind of feeling around in the best that I can in that area. And of course, just the way I frame that, that's both academic, but it's also personal. It's both looking at these cultural systems, but it's also looking at how people try to and often fail to function in the world. And I guess if I could leave my mark, and I hope that I do to a degree in the various courses I teach, it's to let people, young people, know that they can find some tools in their studies that lets them manage the world and manage their mental health a little bit better. And sometimes that's taking a step back from institutionalized religion, which is typically what I have had to do. And sometimes that's looking a little more spiritually into cultural forms like films and music. And if you can find those little pieces there, I think you aren't so much subject to the whims of society, that yeah. you can find your own places of comfort in there.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because my story is a very similar one.
Uh-huh.
Because I did theology. And there's a part of me that, you know, kind of wonders how and why, because even I met it with an old school friend who I actually went to both nursery, primary, and secondary school with.
Oh, wow.
So we go back to, well, yeah. we were both born in 1973. So we must have known each other from 1975 onwards, maybe earlier. And something he said is that he said, I read your reviews. And he said, oh, there's a lot of theology in there and a lot of it goes over my head. And I thought, what? I don't write stuff that goes over people's heads. But then that's really interesting because that's the lens through which I think. So like you, there was never any prospect of me going into the church. But it's interesting that I not only did that degree 30 or so years ago, but I still disseminate all of that. And yet, anybody who knows me through social media and so on knows that I go to the cinema all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not selective about the films that I watch. It's not like I only watch a particular genre of film that fits with my religious work in terms of research and teaching. But isn't it interesting that everyone sort of has a hinterland, but sometimes the best research is when you find yourself that there's a lens that you're working through, but you're not studying something for the obvious, like, career route. It's because that there's interdisciplinary activity going on. And that, you know, and at the end of the day, religion is an area that you can't avoid in any context in society, whether it's, you know, obviously through politics and economics or obviously in the case of both of us, through our interest in film.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in the end, the only thing approximating an answer to for myself about why do I study religion, why have I done this for, you know, 30 years now, is that it's a bone I can't let go of, but it's something I feel like I understand in a way that I don't understand things other than religion quite as well, that it pops for me. I see something in it and I feel like I have something to say about it that other people aren't saying, that apparently, you know, whether it's students or in my writing or my research, other people say, I'm getting something out of how you see this and how you're articulating this. And in fact, one of the times I was teaching religion and film, I think one of my students asked me, well, Dr. Dashke, what kind of films do you like? And obviously, like you, I don't, there's not one kind of film.
That was going to be my next question as well.
Okay, well, I got ahead of you there. But, you know, I said, if I had to boil it down to one thing, I would say I like films that challenge what we think reality is, which is also what I think religion does. And especially what I think the study of religion does, is challenge the way we think religious reality works, whether as an institution or as this kind of, you know, spiritual, transcendent sense of meaning-making that we carry with us, whether we call that religious or not.
Yeah. And is there, I mean, obviously 2001 is big in this. I mean, do you have like a canon of films? I mean, I do this. I always look, I have a stock answer.
Sure.
So if anybody says, what's your favourite sort of film? There's an answer I can give, but that's not to say that if I was to reflect on it, I wouldn't perhaps change. Or, I mean, actually, and I'm serious about this, having only been at Sundance for obviously for the last, 5 days or so, I've seen enough films here for me to think, gosh, you know, if I was to add to my list, you know, I mean, obviously these things take time. You can't just see a film and say, yes, it's my fourth best film ever. You can't do that. But I can certainly see that some of the films here are certainly going to sort of appear on that list, that ever-growing list in years to come.
Well, and I have put together top four or five lists. You can go find me on Letterboxd if you want to see some of the things I put on there. But there's been a very consistent top two since, what was it, 96? Second favorite is Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys. And so there's the apocalypse of it, and like between those two, and they're very, very different styles, right? Obviously, Kubrick is such a classicist, and Gilliam is, you know, surrealist, and among other things, but of course coming out of the Monty Python, and I would even say perhaps number three is Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. So I actually have to have two Gilliam films on there. But, you know, 12 Monkeys, very much about the world as you see it is actually not the world as you see it. Or maybe that's all in your head. We don't know, right? And I think what I love so much about Holy Grail among the Python canon is that it really is challenging what this film is. It's constantly interrupting itself and reminding you that this is a film, and also that this film is kind of broken and it's not doing what a film is supposed to be doing. And so I think those are the kinds of things that delight me. And those are three very different genres that I just cited there. And then there's a few others that maybe I'm less certain about why I love them the way that I do, but Wes Anderson's Rushmore is probably up there number four. And that's in some ways is obviously it presents itself in all these layers of artifice, as Wes Anderson always does there. But that's one that I think is probably as straightforward as a narrative as you're going to get from any of these films that I particularly like. But just every beat of it just is off, off kilter. And it's as many times as I've watched it, I always feel like I'm discovering it for the first time. And then probably I might add, on that list, probably something from Coen Brothers. I might say, variously, I think my favorite of the Coens is either A Serious Man, which is an explicitly religious film
Yeah,
from
very Jewish
very
mysticism.
Jewish, yes, and I love that. And of course, a version of the story of Job, but so many layers to that. But also, then going back to the Bob Dylan, I really love Inside Llewyn Davis. And again, really, really different kinds of films there. And of course, nothing that you can't say about Big Lebowski either, right?
Do you know, it's funny you mentioned the Big Lebowski because
Yeah.
I had this in my head, and actually I don't think it appears in the film, but almost I want it to be there. You know that scene when he has the windscreen smashed in? And yet, this is in my memory at least, that he drives the car without the windscreen, but the windscreen wipers are still going. And I saw the film again, and I don't think that was in it, but I wanted it to be. And that film probably took me a few viewings to actually see where it was going, but when I realized what it was trying to do, and of course you have the whole the like with Jedi is there, but the whole the Church of the Latter-day Dude and
yes,
the,
excellent,
and
which I am cross-ordained in.
Well, I should invite you to give my second religion and film
okay
because we look at that.
Yes. I have a if anybody ever wants the Lebowski package when they want me to do a wedding, I'll say okay, I got something where I say this love, like that rug, really ties the room together. But on the Cohen point too, I'll also say that seeing Raising Arizona in the theaters when I was in college was one of those moments where I realized what film could do, and it was one of those things like with Mad Max: Fury Road or. And we're in Oscar season, Everything Everywhere All at Once. It was one of those times I can absolutely remember walking out of the theater and wanting to walk right back in and watch that movie again. So that was kind of a watershed moment for me. And it would be up at the top of the list, except there's so many great films from the Coens that in some ways have nudged it aside, but only just barely,
And it's funny because the film that I saw this morning, because obviously we're here at Sundance, and it was the Sometimes I Always, Think About Dying. And there's a scene in there where one of the characters is on a date and he has this love of movies. And she says to him, "Why do you like movies so much?" And as I was sitting there, and this probably is the mark of a good movie, because I suddenly thought, gosh, what if somebody asked me that question? Because it's like, you write all these reviews, you go to the cinema all the time, but why do you do it? And sometimes, that takes a lot of unpacking. That's a very hard question to answer because there's a whole layer of biography in there. And I suppose I'm quite good, or I am capable of coming up with the soundbite answers if I have to, if I'm, for an academic sort of context.
Sure.
You have an answer for that you've been using many times before. But isn't that the interesting thing about where our passions come from, what drives us, what makes us do the things that we do. But sometimes these things are infectious, they're organic. And it's the things that kind of, it's the playground thing as well. Like when I was at school, it was always the charts, it was music, it was the favourite records that we all had. And somehow our own personalities came out in the way that we would be able to sort of know that we were confident enough or growing confident enough in ourselves to know that we preferred this song to our best friend's song. And it might be easy to go and say, we like the same stuff, but actually think, no, actually, and I have my own reason for going my own way. And then you take that forward, and then often that can become a vocation.
Yeah, and I think too that kind of to tie it back to the where is this in my career, I think besides the awestruck experience of seeing 2001, I think like I said, I was raised Lutheran. It's even though it's semi-high church, it's a little bit low on ritual compared to some other forms of Christianity. And actually, I had a lot. I had a very good best friend named David Sylvian, and he was Reformed Jewish. And I think I found that there was something kind of interesting and powerful and even exotic about his Judaism that I didn't find in my own religious experience, which I think is the grain for why I found my way into Jewish studies. So thanks to David for that. But I think where I started to really realize what ritual was and what it did was in going to movies and having that whole apparatus of this transition into this different reality. And then this different reality is a combination of narrative, symbols, imagery, and music, in a way that is both real and not real at the same time.
Yeah, what do you think your younger self would have expected you to be doing now? I mean, so when you were, you know, your 5 or your 15-year-old self, could that iteration of yourself have imagined that you were doing what you're doing
now? Oh, no, because I was very much into math and science. And so I very, very much thought that I would probably be in physics, if not engineering. And it wasn't even kind of a question of where I would be. And so much so that when I had my first tour of colleges when I was that age, I toured engineering schools with a friend of mine named Eric. And the best thing I got out of that was to realize I did not want to be an engineer, which is a good time to find that out. Yeah. And it was actually after that that I said, okay, I like science, but I think I also like the humanities. Mm-hmm. And I think I like the thinking about it more than I like the doing of it. Mm-hmm. And so when I was casting about for, well, what does that mean for me? I was looking for programs where I could combine something of a quantitative aspect with a qualitative or something of a science and humanities. And I landed on psychology, which, you know, does that, and especially in the 1980s, before there was really kind of this opprobrium about psychoanalysis and Freud and that school, it was still very, you could study that kind of thing and use the study of psychology a way of exploring what it means to be human, and especially that sense of meaning, and humans as meaning-making creatures. And so, you know, I got, you know, besides being introduced to Freud, I was introduced to Carl Jung. My undergraduate honors thesis was actually a Jungian thesis. And so I still have that strand in me about this sense of individuation and that our experiences are this way of our working our own true selves out. And using narrative and using religious narrative, but using narratives that feel religious to us as a way of doing that, to feel like we have a location in the world, and sometimes that's just in the story that we make for ourselves, or what, you know, what the character that appears to Carl Jung in his biography asks, his autobiography, he says, what is the myth in which you live, which I love as a question.
Yeah.
And so whenever I teach the religion and film course and the psychology of religion course I also do, we spend a little time with the students to say, think about that for yourselves. What is the myth in which you live? What is the story in which you live? And I think that's a really useful way to think back about which stories am I attracted to? Which ones do I keep coming back to? Sometimes they're novels, sometimes they're films, sometimes now they're video games. But we can kind of keep this connection, even if we're not entirely sure what it means and why we like it, hence 2001, but we feel like we have a place in that story.
And because one of the questions I always ask as we start to wrap up is whether your memories are predominantly positive, but twinned with that whole notion of the way that those things that don't make sense, those negative experiences, can sometimes be used for good purposes. And that's what a good film will do, of course.
Oh, sure.
You know, that a film gives you a challenge, and then that challenge is dealt with or processed to various degrees and in different ways. But I guess that's the same for all of our lives, that we take bits.
Yeah.
It's the building blocks, and we sort of put our own identity really on that.
And I think the hardest thing for humans to keep in mind is that we are always in the middle of our own story. And when things are very rough for us, It's hard to imagine not just that they get better, but that there's going to be a time down the line where that will be part of your story. You may even be grateful that you had that part of your story, even as hard as it was, because it led you to the places you're going to be. And there's no way to really appreciate that, but I think it's something we would do well to impart as a culture more that, you know, and I do think that, you know, it gets better is a good thing for us to always remember, but to also remember that that's going to maybe take some time, it's going to go in some directions we don't expect, that we have to have some agency in that, but that very often our stories are taking us places that we could never expect them to go. And then we'll arrive someplace and that's the middle of a different story. Yeah. And then that's going to change. And sometimes you even lose the thing you think you gained. And then that's part of a different story.
Did you know, and I find that with my own students, because they're obviously all there to get their degree.
Yeah.
But they're also there for other reasons. Yeah. They're there because they want to learn. That there's an answer that they're trying to get.
Yeah.
Maybe not an answer, but there are lots of different questions that at least they want to pose. And there are some who are just doing a degree for credit. Sure. There are some who, for whom this is part of a journey. But even for those who are just doing it because they want to get their degree, it's because they want to get a job. So then they have the job. But it's like life is full of all of these that you never have. You don't finish something and then say, that's it. That's it's all wrapped up.
No.
As you say, it's the pretext for another stage of the journey.
And it's super frustrating, you know, being in our culture, mm-hmm. being in the liberal arts and sciences education, because every message you get about college is the opposite of that.
Yeah.
It's very, you know, get there for your degree. The degree is for this job or this career. Employability skills. And once you have that, you're done. You know, you figured it out. You're 21, 22, and you're all done. Of course, that's not at all the case. And if we weren't constantly sending that message, people wouldn't mistake it for the case at all. And, you know, having to constantly sell the liberal arts, even to liberal arts students or sometimes their parents, you know, that, especially in a department of philosophy and religion, which I'm part of, I was chair a number of years ago. But developing our marketing materials, I came up with the phrase that we're a pre-life major. And I like to point out when I have an audience for this, I say, go find a newspaper, look at that front page, and tell me something that isn't philosophy or religion on that front page, whatever it is. And, you know, they can't do it. And usually it's multiple stories. Sometimes it's the main story. And I'm like, you want something that's going to be pragmatic for the rest of your life? Well, learn how to figure out what life is, how to approach it. The employability stuff will follow, especially if you gain skills. But you should know that, you know, all of human history, we've been trying to figure out what it means to be part of this society and part of this arc that starts at birth and ends with death, and that there are things called religions that help us figure that out, but there's also things called art that help us figure out and things called philosophy. And if you are not willing to avail yourself to those things when they're literally being presented to you in a residential setting sometimes for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, then, you know, you're really going to leave not having taken advantage of some of the things that are going to be, they'll be there. They're available. They're always available. And that's actually one thing I like to say. It's like, once you get this and this major, this is there for you for the rest of your life in the ways that some other more pragmatic things are not.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And I've got one more question.
Sure.
Are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I would say that for most of my life, I have been a looking back kind of person, but I can say that I would say, especially, let's say, going back to 2015 or a little bit before, I'm starting to be a looking forward kind of person. And there's a great relief to that. I was someone who carried too many things along the journey with me. Part of that change was when I was doing my sabbatical, and in part took me to Brazil for 5 weeks to work with ayahuasca. And in that time, there was one part of the Santo Daime tradition where They called them aparellos, their instruments, their mediums, and they would channel spirits. And I was in a conversation with one of these spirits, and he recognized, diagnosed me with this, and he said, you know, if you hold on to old things, it leaves no space for something new. Yeah. And that was like one of the greatest things anybody has ever said to me. And so that's part of what how I live my life. If you hold on to old things, there's no place for something new. And I like the new things.
Well, that's a perfect way to end. Derek, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Yeah, and thanks for the invitation. This was a terrific conversation. I had a good time. And really great to meet you and get to know you this week.